got a little bit of sunshine here in Illinois as we begin another edition of Warrior Connection. Well, the summer is rolling away real fast. We're into July, and August is coming around. The headline from a couple days ago in the Army Times, VA reform bill stalled by partisan bickering. Why don't we get surprised on this? I mean, things have been going on and on and on and on. All the information that's been getting out now into the public is what Gary Knoll and his documentaries had out several years ago. Everybody worked with Gary, all the other hard-charging, working senior NCOs and officers have been working on this for a long time. Well, let's continue to talk about it and talk about what's actually happening. Now, Denise, you've been following all this, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to give an update of what happened in the latest round last week. And then we have a couple of vets calling in, and one of them is a vet that just got his claim denied, so we want to talk about what is going on with our claims for our Gulf War vets after we finish this little segment. So anyway, first of all, last week there was a VA House Committee hearing with the acting VA Secretary, Don Gibson. And so he did his testimony. About that time, some of the House of Reps people on the House VA Committee had to leave because the night before, late in the evening, the Chairman Congressman Miller of the House VA Committee, who is on the conference committee for this bill to solve the wait list, okay, which is holding up everything for vets until they take care of this. We can't move on to anything else. And we're running out of time in this session of Congress. But anyway, they scheduled a conference committee hearing in the middle of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. So some of them left the House committee hearing to go join the conference committee of the select senators and House of Reps people from the committees that put on the conference committee, at which time Miller and them approached the problem with how much they would offer as far as funding. Then at the same time, here comes Senator Sanders and the Democrats holding on their own press conference about this conference committee being called in the middle of the House committee hearing. So we have battling parties, and it seems like us vets have become the battleground. But what has happened in reality is the VA asked for $17 billion, with a B, dollars. And when asked about it, they provided a two-page document from the VA of what it would cover. When they asked for more details, they apparently got a three-pager for $17 billion.
$17 billion, three pages.
Yeah, and they need more details of why do you need this money? Where is this money going to be used? We've already, you know, funded, you know, whenever the VA was asking in the past, when the secretaries were asking in the past, do you have enough money? They always said yes, and the appropriations were going up significantly each year in the past several years, and yet we have this problem developing with wait lists, not enough doctors, not enough appointments, wait lists, people can't get in. So there's battle going on, and it all fell apart. But apparently, just reading on Sanders' page, apparently they flew back into D.C. To conference this. So maybe they're breaking the, you know, blockade here. I hope they are. At the committee hearing, when the committee hearing went on, was the service organizations. Now, people need to know that a lot of the service organizations participate in a project they call the Independent VA Budget, where the veteran service organizations, you know, has their own budget figures and what is needed. They, as a group, the service organizations have always said the VA was not being funded enough. So they kind of got a pushback, you know, when Chairman Miller came back in, you know, because they've been defending the VA for asking for $17 billion. And the Republicans saying, well, we'll give them $10 billion to start with, but we've got to know more details, and we'll give them this, and then they can come back and ask for more. Okay?
Well, you know, with asking for money, I mean, it's the same thing. You know, not telling you, we know they started giving out all kinds of bonus for individuals that did not do the work, ensured that the wait lists and all this stuff were doing. They spent an incredible amount of money, millions of dollars, on conferences that didn't do any good. They've been out there throwing out perfectly good furniture, buying new furniture that didn't need to be replaced. they were sponsoring a NASCAR race car. And I love NASCAR, okay?
Yeah.
But they're sponsoring a race car. What that has to do with, you know, medical care for the VA is beyond me. And then they asked for all these millions of dollars to solve the wait list and appointment times. But as we know, and hopefully this vet that you've got now is going to call in or have called in already and waiting for us, is the fact that they're denying disability. So 4 out of 5 disability claims have been denied.
No,
they're disavowing any connection. And it's a whole policy issue of lie and deny. And so you can spend all the money you want out unless that policy changes and the decision is made to accept and support and advocate. What good is it?
Well, that's true. And, Doug, the rate for Gulf War vets is 80% denied. 80% denial on claims. And that's why I asked a couple of our vets to call in, because one or two more of our vets got notified that we're in touch with that their claims were denied last week. Wanted to know, has anybody called in yet? Has anybody called in yet?
Please call in 888-874-4888. Please call in.
Okay. Hopefully they will call in. You know, it's heartbreaking. We have people putting their claims in and really suffering and, you know, not having a way to continue their job. Some of them are pressing through and working until they can't work anymore. They put off putting claims in, and then when they put claims in, they get denied, you know, and they're suffering. As you mentioned to me over the phone about some people up in your area hitting the...
Yeah, we had a female veteran, again, a year working on the claim story, was in the Champaign News-Gazette yesterday, which would have been Saturday morning, and she didn't even have the money to buy groceries, and then she went to the Veterans Assistance Commission, and they didn't have the money. As the VSO said, the claim has been in limbo for a year. I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous, because whether you're Desert Storm, OIF, OEF, OND, Vietnam, or whatever, the internal documents, we post them up there. Gary Noel, God bless him, has got them all over his documentary and posted up there. And again, Joyce Riley does, and Beyond Treason and all the other ones. There's no question about the health effects of all the toxic exposure, because the internal memorandum confirm it and direct it. But then they deny it when you get your claim in. I mean, that's what they've done to me personally. I mean, the Army is saying you're not physically fit because of neuropathy, so we want you to take your medical evaluation board. However, the VA says that it didn't happen, it doesn't exist, and there's no service connection. I mean, that's what they're doing to me and what they're doing to all these other kids. Now, hopefully these ones that have been denied, please call in. Please call in, 888-874-4888. My producer is ready, standing by, waiting for you to call in.
Okay, and you know what I'm hearing is the VSOs, if they have not handled Gulf War illness claims, you know, people, you need to ask when you're going to any veteran service organization, be it Legion, be it VFW, be it your county or your state level or Paralyzed Veterans of America, Purple Heart is really good. I mean, they've got a slideshow out about Gulf War veterans claims, okay, and they've stayed on top of it pretty well. But you need to ask that service officer, have you handled Gulf War veteran claims on the Gulf War illness issue? Have you been successful? Do you have the knowledge to help me and guide me through this process?
That knowledge, again, is the documentation and all the internal memorandum that confirm the health effects and direct medical care. But we're seeing that, I mean, I'm still seeing the same thing and trying to get it my own doctor. Do you have this a couple of days ago? And they still don't have it, even though I've given it to the Danville, Ileana VA Medical Center Administration a million times for me and Rollo and everybody else. And it's just like, there's something really wrong because...
Well, let's talk about the claims and hope our people are going to call in.
We'll wait
a minute or two and see if they call in. But first of all, Gulf War vets, do not claim Gulf War syndrome. That's an old term. It was something DOD hatched. Don't call it Gulf War illness. You know, the regulation is 38 CFR. You need to read the regulation and refer to it in their same language. They talk about chronic fatigue. They talk about fibromyalgia. They talk about irritable bowel syndrome, other problems, okay? That's how you need to address your claim. It's exactly off the 38 CFR, okay? You list your symptoms. Now, you're going to have backup documentation showing that those symptoms are there for 6 months minimal, okay? That's chronic nature. And then, you know, if you're going to civilian doctors, there's what they call DBQ, disability questionnaires. You can download those from the VA website. Go to www.va.gov, type in their little search document, DBQ. That's Delta Bravo Quebec, DBQ. Okay? You pull up the appropriate forms. You take it to your doctor. You get him to fill out the DBQ. Now, one thing you want to be careful on, if symptoms occur on the DBQ forms for chronic fatigue, fibro, IBS, there's some overlap. You want to highlight where there's an overlap. If there's an overlap on those three areas and you're claiming all three, you only want the doctor to check on one form, not on all three. Okay? That will mess you up. They call that stacking, I think is what the term is. You can only claim one symptom for one of those three. You can't claim the same thing on those DBQs. The second thing is if you're going to a civilian, make sure it's an expert. Rheumatology people will diagnose fibromyalgia. Do some checking before you go to a civilian doctor, that they have the expertise and that they know about fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, irritable bowel. You know, they've got to have some expertise in it. If it's a general practice doctor, not going to go with four. So you get them to fill out the forms. You get their cover letter stating what they've seen in you as a patient, what testing they have done, and how they're diagnosing you, what diagnosis they have given. And they've tried to test to rule out anything else. And you want them to make a statement of how it's related to your military service, okay? There's three ways it can be. Least likely, related. Okay? Equal chance, as much as possible, you know, or even equal chance. Or more than likely, okay? Those are key wordings. Then you want to get the doctor's curriculum vitae. That is the doctor's or professional's form of resume. It states where he trained, where he got his degree, what specialties he's had board exams in, where he's worked. If he's had any publications, it lists that. That sets him up as an expert. You're building a case, whether you're going to a court or not. This is going into the VA, or if you use it for Social Security disability, the same thing. You've got to show the expertise of that doctor, okay? So those are some items I can say that are needed. I'm not a claims person. I've worked my claim with a service organization. I would not recommend somebody doing it on their own. Find a good VSO.
I'm looking at the Chapter 5, and the provisions applied. This is one quote, when making decisions on or taking action on claims that require a rating decision, the rating and veteran services representative must apply for the provisions of all the pertinent laws, regulations, schedules for rating disabilities, policy statements, procedures, administrator's decisions, secretary's decisions, court appeals for veterans' claims, precedents, and other legal precedents governing Department of Veteran Affairs. So those, when they're making the decision, this is stuff in Chapter 5, what they're much do. And what it comes back on to, it very simple. You've got administrative decisions, and you've got secretary decisions, and you've got policy statements leading the charge.
Okay.
And that's where we've run into from the problems on day one.
Right. Now, we'll ask, has anybody called into our show? Please speak up if you've called in.
Phone number is 888-874-4888. Please call in.
Okay. We'll wait and see if anybody calls in, Doug. But, you know, I'm going to try to line up some people to be on the show in the future. Might be a month down the road. But some VSOs that are very good are some people that work within the system to help guide vets if they're able to, even under anonymous conditions. But there's a lot you need to know. You need to listen to people that are VSOs that have handled Gulf War illness claims, or the undiagnosed, what do you want to call it, that they've been successful. And, you know, if you have access to other people that work in the system itself, they're actually doing the job, and they're willing to talk to you. They're trying to guide you. You know, I caution people to utilize these people. Whether you put together a lot of your stuff, you always want a VSO to help you and guide you, and you want one knowledgeable. So you need to interview them, okay? When I went out to find a VSO, primarily I'd like a Gulf War vet that's, you know, dealt with the stuff himself, that has experience. Maybe he was with the organization first, and then he got hired by the state to be a county service officer, which a lot of them are. If they get hired by the county or state, they've usually worked with a VSO before, okay? That shows kind of their track record. But you want to interview them and see if they're, you know, that they're going to be persistent on your claim, if they're knowledgeable, if they've been successful in guiding people and helping people. It takes a lot. You've got to do your part in collecting records and get it together, but you count on that person to guide you.
You know, the other thing, too, and I mean, I got to come back to this. This is the thing that burns my craw and a lot of other individuals, especially around here. When you work with a VSO, a veteran service officer, and they disavow that the documents exist, or they don't go out and provide them, because one thing that you and I both learned and we've seen over and over again, and this is where the burn pits come into play, specifically going back to Desert Storm, is the internal documents are all there, okay? But the soldier doesn't have them. They've never seen them. What we're finding out and what I learned out is the command structure within the military is definitely not going to provide it.
Okay.
Still had a problem the other day with, even though the administration, given the documents, the administration of the Danville Ilya VA Medical Center have the documents, they don't provide them to the doctors.
Yeah.
But so that's a horrible nightmare.
Let me state this. You are not fighting a Gulf War illness claim on exposures. Okay. You're fighting it on the disabilities of what's been diagnosed, or if they couldn't diagnose it and gave you a chronic fatigue or fibro diagnosis. You do not have to prove exposures as a Gulf War veteran. So all this running around about vaccines versus chemicals versus burn pits versus the sand, the dust, the DU, doesn't apply when you're talking about the claim. There are presumptives on the books. And for people to still be running around 23 years later trying to nail it down to one exposure, of course, we agree that there's not one exposure because the symptoms are going to overlap.
And they're synergistic in nature. So when you're zapped by one physiological system that's affected, and you have those consequences, signs and symptoms medically, another zap is going to cause more problems. And it's not additive in nature, it's synergistic in nature. Another 1 + 1 is not 2. 1 + 1 could be 3, 5, 7, or 9, or just another little zapping. What's happened to individuals again? It takes them over the crisis mode, because then the body's physiological response is into a crisis mode where you had a subacute reaction, and all of a sudden you have a severe acute reaction. I mean, that's happened to all of us.
But again, your claims are based on medical documentation. Now, the only reason that you would want to go dig around, and one of our vets had this and died from it. His wife was very successful, but he was an MP in a prisoner of war area, you know, where they contained him, and they were using lindane to delouse these prisoners. Now, she had been turned down. He died of a cancer. That's when you have to go digging to make connections. she did it successfully, researching Lindane, getting scientists and researchers and doctors to back her up and documentation.
Well,
that's the only reason. If you have a diagnosis that's not a presumptive, whether it's Agent Orange or whatever, and it's not a presumptive, then you're going to have to do work like that to say, this exposure leads to cancer and this type of cancer, and getting a letter from your experts, your doctors. That's the only time that you would have to reach out to do other work. But for the general Gulf War claims, you're not going to have to track down your exposures. I mean, we're not able to do that, number one. The records aren't there for the vaccines. The records aren't there fully and completely for the exposures, and never will be, probably.
Well, yeah, we got to remember, as we know, in the GAO, Kwai Chan, Sushil Sharma had totally documented, as did others, a series of investigative journalists, that, you know, the stuff was ordered destroyed. I mean, both you and I were involved in the conversations during the hearings on the Hill when MedCom, Third MedCom, ordered the records destroyed in Florida. So what can you do?
So do we have any call-ins yet? Anybody that has called in, please speak up.
Okay, 888-874-4888.
Okay. What I'm seeing happening, though, generally with claims, and it's sad to see, but and what they were showing in the hearings is to get the claims numbers down. What they were doing a lot of times is kind of stamping these if they were a weak case and filed wrongly instead of giving benefit of the doubt to the veteran or recontacting the veteran and giving assistance as they should. They don't do that. So they, you know, mark it denied, and then you either have to ask for a reconsideration or a mistake, clear and evident, you know, of an error made, a notice of disagreement. You want to go those first steps before you ever consider going to appeals at the appeals court. But what they were doing is if the claim was lacking stuff, they denied it. Therefore, it pushes the vets over to, you know, do the next step, which is notice of disagreement for a reconsideration at the regional level. They're going to need to submit material, the vet is, or the VSO help, is going to have to go through why they were denied. It's usually spelled out in the letter of what was denied and how you can take care of that. You know, you've got to read that carefully and ask for guidance on that of what was needed. But, you know, that's what was happening, to get the claims numbers down, because they want to get the claims numbers down by what, 2015, Doug? Is that the date?
Yeah, something like that. But again, you know, getting the claims numbers down is different from making sure that all the individuals that are sick, ill, or have injuries or wounds or anything get their claims and everything through. So getting the claims number down, and this is the thing that, I mean, just advocates, you know, I'm just gets me madder and blue blazes and everybody else around, is that you would think that the VBA and all those individuals up there would be the strongest advocates for the veterans to put all this stuff together. And it's still the other thing around. Now, another thing, this has come out, let's talk about this for a moment, is extremely important because this gets to the heart of everything. The wrist, who we've talked about a lot on here, you got a wrist in Washington, D.C., one up in East Orange, one in California, we talked about them. They have now put out the document called the Wrist Advantage, summer of 2014, dealing with the VA's Airborne Hazards and Open Burn Pit Registry. Now, this goes back to Desert Storm. It's not just OIF-OEF. And, quote, veterans may hear the term airborne hazards and wonder what types of exposures are included. Airborne hazards are particulate matter and gaseous air pollutants that come from a number of sources, such as burning human and non-human solid waste, smoke from structural fires and explosions, smoke from burning oil wells, dust and sand particles, industrial ambient air pollution, aircraft and automobile engine exhaust, and on and on and on. And so the process of what's supposed to happen now, you can go onto the VA website and try to get to it. and that's at veteran.mobilehealth.com. M-O-B-I-L-E, health, H-E-A-L-T-H, .va.gov. And then you'll try to get in there. I tried to get in there and get into it. Wouldn't work on a dial-up here in a rural thing. But the process is the veteran registers and completes the VA Airborne Hazards and OPIT Registry self-assessment. Veteran decides if they would like to be evaluated, and if so, contact their local VA hospital. VA provider will review registry questionnaire, complete airborne hazards evaluation, recommend any specialty tests if needed that can be completed at the home VA, develop a plan for the next steps as needed, and then discuss with the veteran. And then finally, a last step, and both you and I have been involved in this, and again, it's extremely important, home VA provider considers referring veteran to the risk for evaluation for further unique testing based on the individual need and initial evaluation. So the Matt Reinhardt and all the staff at the RIS in Washington, East Orange, that are trying to get all this stuff through. But again, how do we get this implemented? And this problem we're running into, especially here at the Danville ILEA and the VA Medical Center, getting it fully implemented where the VA just knows what to do. It's up there on the website, but somehow it all disappears in the thing. But this is extremely important. And again,
this
in the
is a
process,
brand new thing they started about a month ago.
Yeah, but it's brand new. But again, we have to understand that all this stuff, and this is extremely important. I talked to Dr. Reinhardt about this the other day, quite a while, and we have a lot. As mentioned in here, this goes back to Desert Storm.
Right.
You know, burn pits started in Desert Storm. All this stuff started, and then God bless him, he's an angel and all, Colonel Dr. Andres Carnegie Bopp. I mean, he wrote that paper. When did he write that paper, Alaskan disease?
Oh, gosh, that was out in 93. It was with a military medical journal.
Yeah, he identified it in day one because he was a member of Bauer's Raiders.
It was the very first article that I found, and I quoted it when I was up there in April of 94 at the NIH hearing, a conference on the health consequences of the Gulf War. And when I quoted it and making my way back to my seat, here I hear his voice of, "You quoted my paper." I never dreamed that would happen, but I quoted his initial paragraphs, and it was opening a Pandora's box.
The number of lives that Andres saved during Desert Storm, providing medical care, setting up medical care protocols and treatment as a senior, position on Bauer's Raiders was staggering. I mean, there's no way to describe the good that he did along with the rest of the team, but now too many of them are all dead or sick and dying.
Right.
It's
has anybody
horrible.
Called into our program yet? Anybody that has called in, please speak up now.
888-874-4888 is the number.
Okay. Doug, I want to talk about some of the problems. I talked to one of our vets, and I was hoping he could call in today. He hasn't called in yet. I did notify him to. But, and I sure hope our operator is there to get him on the program, because I mentioned it to him when I called in, because we asked him to call in, and sometimes the operator's not there to get him plugged in, and we apologize for that if it happens to you. Like I said, when I called in today, I told them there'd be call-in people. So, anyway, what I see is some problems when I talk to vets and try to figure out what's going on is they have not used DBQs with civilian doctors. They may have very well had civilian doctors, but never thought of using a DBQ, having the cover letter, and having the curriculum vitae included. There's also a problem with getting VA physicians to fill out those forms. And I think the reason that the VA physicians don't want to use it is that these are the actual questions used in a compensation and pension exam. Okay? So the physicians at the VA do not feel like they need to fill it out because it will be covered in the CMP exam. Now, when you're scheduled for a CMP, those CMPs are triggered by your claims being put in. And the VARO, the regional office person that's working your claim, will trigger the response to schedule you for CMP exams. Now, if you're a Gulf War vet and you get scheduled for CMP exams, I want you to be sure that when you get scheduled, if you put in for any of the presumptives, that you get a Gulf War CMP. It's a general Gulf War. They will cover chronic fatigue, fibro, IBS. That's the other thing, is if they don't schedule you for a CMP for like the general Gulf War one, which usually they slot out like 4 hours for that. Mine took forever going through it. The other two were very brief and abbreviated. The other thing is if they don't do that, at least be sure they put in for a CMP exam for the specific, you know, like chronic fatigue or fibro. I've had vets tell me that they were claiming fibro but never got a CMP exam for it, that their VA doctors didn't use the pressure points, VA doctors would not fill one out, they didn't get a CMP triggered for the right thing. That is when you need to get with your VSO, and there's a general message form they can fill out and send to the VARO office saying he was scheduled for these CMPs, he did these, okay? But he filed for chronic fatigue, fibro, IBS, or the symptoms under Gulf War illness or undefined illnesses. He has not been scheduled for those CMPs. It should trigger, you know, another CMP to be scheduled. So I've seen that happen. These are just little technicalities that I'm finding by talking to our vets get turned down, even though I'm not a certified claims person. If they're claiming that and they don't get a CMP in relationship to it, that is what the VARO triggers, okay? And if they're not being scheduled for those, you need to go back through your VSO, have them notify the VA regional office that, you know, you did in your claim file for those, and yet you haven't been scheduled for that CMP exam. That's very critical right there. Now, has anybody called in? Has anybody called in to the program? Hello? Am I still connected? Doug, are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. Everything was quiet. I'm going to we get disconnected or something.
Yeah, that has happened sometimes before, but again, I think the overall total frustration.
I think we just had a call in, maybe. I got a little static. Did somebody call into the show? If you did, please speak up. Okay, Doug, I'll let you continue the conversation.
Yeah, I guess I'm sitting here and I'm going back again in the conversation. I'm looking at the risk advantage again on the airborne hazards. And again, this is cumulative, coming back all the other stuff, things. And again, the whole thing, the registry was established by the VA to help keep veterans informed about scientific studies, including long-term studies of airborne hazards, as well as emergency treatments on airborne hazard-related concerns. Additionally, it will also help VA to monitor the health conditions affecting veterans as a result of airborne hazards exposures. All data collected will be used to improve programs at the VA to help veterans with deployment exposure concerns. Now, again, that's what the intent is, and in talking with Dr. Reinhardt, obviously, it's clear as a bell, and he intends to do it. But again, it comes on down to the same thing, in the hospitals or at the VA things, what we have to have, and again, a strong recommendation that I'm coming up with, and Denise, this was in your recommendations from the beginning at IOM, is the doctor and the medical staff at the hospital, the nurses and all those stuff, got to be strong advocates for the veteran, and the same thing for the patient advocates. One thing that bothers me on the patient advocate thing is, why do you have to have a patient advocate if everything is done right? And then if you go to a patient advocate, they should have all the medical information, the documentation, the medical records, they should have the internal directives, they should have the confirmation of the health effects as a result, signs and symptoms for the known toxic exposures. In other words, a veteran doesn't know. They need to get the help and have somebody there within the hospital to be an advocate. And then Dr. Reinhardt told me the continuing medical education is still a friggin' nightmare.
Yeah, and we know that. When you have the patient, the veteran, the client, the user, that's every day I hear my VA doctor doesn't know what's going on. And if they try to provide documentation to the doctors, you know, they're kind of looked at cross-eyed of here's my patient bringing stuff in. But that's what we've been trying to do is provide the information to them if they're not getting it. And if they don't have time, which a lot of them don't if they're seeing their max patient load, okay, is they don't have time to get this. There's no continuing education requirement. And having been a nurse, I'm going, hey, every medical person, every year, you have to document you've had so many continuing medical education units when you, you know, pay your dues for the year for your licensure board in each state. And one of the things they're not doing is thinking about what we've said to them over and over again. Use the VA RAC and the research, you know, reports as part of the process to educate. Okay, it's not just the VA documentation. It's like IOM. It's like the Research Advisory Committee for the VA for Guffaw Illness. It's like the researchers that have done projects and gotten them published. Get a live video hookup. Have these experts talking to them and how it should relate to the clinician at each hospital. And then you have a short quiz at the end. You know, being that they listened and heard you and did a little reading, and make it a certified course for continuing medical education. They have never done that.
You know, the big thing for it goes back again, we're from another generation, but when I was teaching the emergency medicine EMT course here in Illinois and then the 91-89-1B for the Army, we not only took it upon ourselves continuing medical education, it wasn't a 7:30 to 4 or 8 to 5 job at all. But there's something changed in the mentality where the individual today, and I've had this conversation just recently again the other day at the Danville VA Medical Center here in Danville, Illinois. If I don't have time to do it between 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon on my job, I'm not going to do it. I have my life and my job, and I'm not going to do that. And that, from a professional point of view, for me, that is disturbing because there are so many patients and they're so busy during the day that they're wasting time. And one of the things that I advocate and had this conversation with Dr. Reinhardt again the other day, if we had the continuing education, they took the time up and beyond, learn what's going on, how to put it and how to deal with all this stuff, they can probably save time on each and every patient, and the amount of time and the efficiency and effectiveness of medical care is going to skyrocket.
Yeah.
But you're stumbling, what I'm thinking I'm happening, what I see personally is they're stumbling around in the dark and not doing a true case history. I mean, when you went through all this stuff in your nursing, okay, you started nursing almost, close to 40 years ago.
You're dating me here, but...
But, you know, that's the reality, Denise.
Yeah.
I mean, you got your hands on the patient, you asked and talked to them, and you got your fingers in there, and you got everything. Today, what I've seen when you go to the doctor, they got their head stuck in a computer, and they're marking down a checklist and said, okay, what's happening to you? Okay, well, take off your shirt. Let me see it. Oh, you got a rash here? What's it look like? How does it feel? What aggravates it? Oh, you got a respiratory problem.
How many of our Guffaw vets, I'm probably going to throw this out on some Facebook pages, because we've had complaints of rashes. And I want to know how many times that they went in with a rash, did they get referred to dermatology? Did dermatology take pictures of the rash and document it, and try to give a diagnosis or do some testing on it? I had a rash lately on the lower legs. You know, I went in, basically told, take this cream and do this and that. No prescription, no testing. You know, and I'm going, hey, you know, I want to be sure it's not something like clothisciomyosis with skin lesions showing up. And so I don't even think they're educated on clothisciomyosis, you know. But it was the same reaction I had back in the early 90s when I went to the registry exam. And I had a rash then. I said, you know, I have this rash. Oh, go to your civilian dermatologist was their answer at that time. At least now we get referred, if you're in the system, to dermatology for a consult, but they're not really being inquisitive of why these rashes. Now, I do have a page on Facebook where people can post their pictures of their rashes. My intent on this was I wanted to have pictures. I wanted to see what vets were getting diagnosed with on their rash, what was helping them deal with the rash, what testing was being done on them. I have every intention of taking this, you know, iPad-wise, and setting up a meeting with a dermatologist over at University of Colorado and say, look at this. What do you think? I want some feed-in. I want some articles written on the rashes, just like we need on dental care and problems with Gulf War veterans. We need an article on the eye problems that are developing early in life to look at those areas that are not being looked at. I mean, we've had research on the neurological issues, the hypercoagulation, the mitochondrial cell disorders coming out. But these other areas, call them auxiliary areas, be it dental, hearing, rashes, you know, are not having any look-see, okay, with a researcher that specializes in that area to say what it could be and to get involved and see 100 Gulf War vets with the rashes and do some research on it.
You know, the rashes started right away when we got over in theater. They were rashes were showing up in the, you know, in the fall of 1990. And in our case, in our teams, my rash has been there from, you know, boom, right when we started with the DU mess, much less before, and you had all of this stuff. I mean, we know we had water contamination from the oil wells. We had that stuff, skin irritation. We had clothing irritation. I mean, one thing and another.
Doug, I've got about two or three of them that are very severe, okay, that I know of. And I know they're seeing expert doctors. And I turn around and encourage them to have their expert doctors even write it up as a case study. You know, there's a journal of dermatology, I'm sure. I haven't looked at it, but, you know, to write it up as a case study, what they have found so far, even as an individual case study. I mean, I've been in touch with one for a long time, lives up in Iowa, and he was shipped home out of theater because he could not get a seal with his mask because of the rashes. He has had significant troubles. He's gone to a lot of specialists trying to treat this. I mean, it's very, very impairing to him. And yet no one's written up even a case study. I know of another one that we've had pictures that, you know, they ended up having to have a lot of muscle and tissue excised, never written up in a journal. I mean, if you do not share your knowledge as doctors of what you are seeing, even in a case study format in a medical journal, then all the rest of the doctors are blind to it and never gets published.
Well, that was part of the decisions. If we remember, you know, they weren't going to allow publishing a certain information, everything. That was what Roger and Kilpatrick and the PSOB had put in place in the IOM. I mean, I never forget the IOM meeting. Well, no, you know, Harold Sox was saying, no, you can't ever get that publisher put up. And I mean, it's kind of like, what is wrong with this picture? But again, and if you go back to Andres Carnegie Botha, the CDC, he tied all this stuff together, all these complex toxic exposures from the military are symptomatic of the low-level continuous toxic exposures in throughout housing and everything else. So we're seeing the sick building syndrome, we're seeing all these disabilities, we're seeing learning disabilities in the children. You know, as Andres has said, you know, the chemical exposures are the same thing as what we're seeing with Alzheimer's.
You know, a good patient education for the doctors would be Dr. Klimas' slide presentation that she presented to the RAC. I put that slide presentation out for the vets to read and download and print out and take to their doctors. But Dr. Klimas has been treating, first of all, her background people. She started out with AIDS patients. As AIDS patients were taken care of, the retroviral medication, And as their needs decreased, she went into looking at chronic fatigue in the civilian population, okay? And she was very busy with the civilians. And then she, you know, got involved with the Gulf War veterans. She is very educated, very informed doctor, okay? She's going to be, I mean, she's leading the way out there as far as seeing patients and trying to help them. And her presentation to the RAC about treatment is a must for doctors in the VA to review, I mean, with a, just a little bit of things on that. They, if they taped it up at her RAC presentation, get that tape, you know, the video, her slide presentation, use that or have her, you know, directly, you know, talking to them live on a live webinar, you know, and have them talking about treatment modalities that she's using. That would be an excellent way to start educating our doctors in the VA. We have to, I think, scream and yell, because that is one of the key components that's missing, is the education of the doctors, having the knowledge for Gulf War veterans. And then I go back to when I was at the VA hospital this last week, I went back to an idea that it had in the 90s and tried to get it in the 90s. And I said, well, with everything going on at the VA, maybe they would want something positive. So I wrote it up for the director of the VA hospital of, you know, we have a lot of attention being paid on the OIF, OEF patients. We have hospitals that have PAC teams devoted to them to look at their whole system. They're not doing it with the Gulf War vets. Why don't we have at least a task force that meets even even once or twice a year would be an improvement, but at each major VA hospital where the patients can take part and the doctors can take part, maybe have a little video presentation from one of our excellent people, Dr. Guillaume, Dr. Klimas, Dr. Baronet, whoever you want to have, you know, have it on a rotating basis, and have a task force to start hearing us at the local level and what are the problems and how they can improve in even small ways. Even small ways, Doug, of if their doctors do not believe in this, then they shouldn't be seeing Gulf War veteran patients.
Amen.
You know? I mean, that's a number one. If your doctor at the VA says, I don't believe in all this, go track right down to the chief of staff patient advocate and put in for a change of doctor.
I mean, it's not a matter of belief, because we know the physiological problems are happening from all the stuff that occurred. There's no question about that. It's thoroughly documented in the epidemiology and everything else. So the doctor should be the strongest advocate, but coming back onto the same thing. How do you change medical practices from that have altered and forgotten, got their head stuck in the computer rather than at the patient level?
Well, Doug, it's, you know, it's an outgrowth of the culture. Just like the whole breakdown on the wait list and how they had a culture to hide those. This is part of the culture problem, that you are there for the vets, to serve the vets. That is your job, okay? And if that culture is not meeting the needs, which we've seen in the scandal that's developed in the healthcare of not getting the patients in, you know, the denial of his claims and the problems with claims. Until we fix this culture, and it comes from the top, and it comes from the bottom, and it comes from every level of VA, they have been bloated in bureaucracy. And we've seen that with a number of people at headquarters and at the regional, you know, vision level. And then we don't have enough doctors, or the doctors are not having the efficiency and seeing the number of patients they should. I mean, you know, one of the hearings, one of the doctors that was outstanding became a whistleblower. He said, you know, he was in mental health. And he said, you know, our vets aren't getting seen. And he started looking around to see how many patients each provider was seeing. And I was blown out of my seat. You're only seeing maybe three patients in a day? yes, mental health takes longer, but, you know, if your appointment's only an hour and you're spending 3 hours out of an eight-hour day, what is going on here? We're paying these people a full salary. Some of them got bonuses, and they're only seeing three patients. And I'm also going to say something else. The Legion did excellent work out of Phoenix. They brought in a crisis center led by the Legion, okay? They had claims people. They had all kinds of people. They brought in a mobile, you know, mobile facilities that they could get some people seen right then and there. There's been things done of adding hours. Now, why shouldn't a VA have later hours? They're closing at 4 o'clock, 4:30. They're not even staying up until 6. We have veterans that are still trying to work a job. You know, they haven't gotten their claim through. They're still working a job, and they can't get in.
We've got to remember, just for say for an hour appointment, I've got an hour drive each direction, so I've got to leave it. You got to be there 30 minutes or 15 minutes beforehand. So you're leaving, and you got an hour and a half before your appointment. And maybe you got an hour appointment or a 15-minute appointment. Then you got an hour, you know, you got an hour and a half to travel back. So for a 15-minute appointment, you're blowing out 4 hours of your day, and you can't work that day if you're going to do anything, because if you got an appointment at 9:30 in the morning or 10 in the morning, there's no way you're going to get back to work by 3 in the afternoon.
And I go, why don't we have some evening hours added? Why don't we do some Saturday appointments to be sure they get through this wait list, okay? Saturday and Sundays. I mean, I found out the claims department people are getting overtime. They're in there. I got a phone call on a Sunday. So they've authorized them overtime. And I think they ought to do the same with doctors, okay? And you'd have to have some lab people there, which maybe normally you'd only have a few if there's a VA ER there, but you'd have to have some lab people able to go and draw some blood and that kind of thing. They may have to come back for radiology, unless the radiology can put on an extra person. You know, you have to have the support services. But they did that out in Phoenix. Led by the American Legion. I have to say, in the past, I haven't really been a whole ringleader for the Legion, but what they got out there and did out in Phoenix, I've got to salute them. And if it's a problem with space requirement, we have some mobile VA vans set up that you could do exams in. You know, I've seen them. They use them, you know, at meetings. They bring them in. I go, well, what are they doing during the week with these, you know? But, you know, if it's a space requirement, I mean, I think we could handle space requirement without billions of dollars to at least get through the wait list. I have to question some of what's being asked for, too, when they only get two or three pages to document $17 billion request. And some of that, you know, was spaced out for 2 years, which should be in the normal approach process.
I think the other thing, too, they've got to look at, and I'm looking at the clock all of a sudden. We're starting to run out of time here. There's another caution I want to put out, and I was talking to another friend that's working with veterans, not a VSO, but a guy that's working with them, helping them on a daily basis. And it's a problem you and I have seen, we've talked about before. Ladies and gentlemen, you got to give up the alcohol. You got to give up, misuse of drugs and everything else, and nicotine and caffeine. Got to maintain a proper diet, because we're seeing the same thing. And I mean, going back to the Vietnam War, where I've been totally in Denise, you and I go back to that time.
Yeah.
The misuse of alcohol by the veterans is staggering. I mean, we're still seeing it. We're seeing even more, because the total frustration with all the problems are driving people to, you know, or go back on the alcohol or whatever, the drugs, the street drugs, or the, you know, misuse of prescription drugs to get by. And, I mean, that word of caution, I mean, when it reminded me again the other day, I'm talking to this guy, and he said, yeah, I'm seeing that horrible thing where the guys are so flustered, they're, you know, go out there and drinking, and then they can't function when they do.
Yeah, I mean, if you're drinking every day, guys, you're killing your liver. It's not going to help. The liver processes the waste products of the body and the kidneys. And, you know, guys, you got to stop the damage you're doing. The alcohol is a big number. Illegal drugs use. And I'm not going to bring marijuana into it at all. Other illegal drugs, okay? And using somebody else's prescription medicines or whatever is just not appropriate. You're not helping yourself in that way. And, in fact, it really puts your body in an out-of-control spin. Doesn't take much to do that. And alcohol is a depressant. No way around it. And if you're already having problems and stress factors or your claim being denied, your doctor not listening, your wife leaving you because she's thrown up her hands, whatever, you know, using alcohol is just an added thing that just leads to more problems, you know, and at least stop that. It's not helping your body, and then we get depressed, and then we have the suicides happening.
Well, look at us, and look, go back to the risk news here. The main key thing, again, D.C. is working on this overall airborne hazards educational efforts. California risk, you've already been out there. I think, Denise, you said you're getting ready to go on out there, the airborne hazard. New Jersey risk is focusing on cognitive issues and mitochondria issues. So, I mean, there's stuff happening out there that's really critical to overall care for everybody. But when you look at all this stuff put together, it's no wonder everybody's in such a physiological mess and in total frustration.
And if we looked at it, Doug, you know, it really starts with the doctors and the practitioners. And if they're not documenting things, it makes it harder to get your claim through. If they're not documenting things, they're not helping the veterans with their normal care. I mean, we've had veterans go to war-related illness, and then their provider they go back to ignores a recommendation from the risk.
Well, that happened to you and I both.
You know, the risk makes a, you know, a second opinion, like a super-duper consult, and you should be following that. So, you know, when I look at the system overall, there's a lot of problems. But the key factor is your physicians. And the key factor is the policies and the culture and procedures within the VA hospital. I truly believe this is an excellent opportunity to fix the VA. Doug, we were both around during Vietnam. You went to Vietnam. I served during the Vietnam era. I trained. One of my rotations was at the VA hospital when I went through nursing school. I can tell you the Vietnam vets raised Cain. It made a difference. They got the vet centers. Things were cleaned up. Well, it's time for the younger generation to stand up and let's finish the job. Let's make this system what it should be for all.
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't, get to GaryKnoll.com and get the documentaries. You need to watch those. Get all the information. Share it with your legislative newspapers, reporters, family, and everybody else. Thank you very much. Denise, thank you. Let's keep going on this whole topic.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.